morning.
Good morning.
If it pleases the court, this case falls under the McDonald versus Bowen decision, which was rendered, I believe, in 1986, with one slight difference. Mr. Hildebrand was injured in an automobile accident and in October of 1994 and filed a claim for Social Security disability insurance benefits. Subsequent to the filing of this claim, and after 5 months, but before 12 months, Mr. Hildebrand returned to work. The case proceeded through the administrative process until it reached an administrative law judge who decided that Mr. Hildebrand was not disabled because he did not satisfy the duration requirements of the Act and the regulations. The duration requirements are that the impairment which prevents the claimant from working must either be expected to result in death, or the impairment has lasted or is expected to last for a continuous period of no less than 12 months. Those are the three elements of the definition of disability. Now, McDonald emphasizes the fact that a person can receive disability insurance benefits if he or she returns to work prior to 12 months. If he or she has been found disabled for at least five continuous months, but even though the impairment itself may not in fact last for a continuous period of 12 months. And under such circumstances, that person is entitled to a trial work period. Now, when a person is entitled to a trial work period under the Social Security Administration regulations, the work that that person is doing in the trial work period itself is not considered when the issue of the disability itself is that is the ability to do substantial gainful activity, that's SGA, is in question. And of course, the ability to do SGA does have a bearing upon whether a person can be considered to be disabled. We believe that the ALJ erred in this particular case primarily because he has put us into a situation of complete circularity. Mr. Hildebrand is not entitled to disability insurance benefits because he doesn't, according to the ALJ, that is, because he doesn't satisfy the duration requirement. The evidence, according to the ALJ, does not reasonably establish that he was unable to perform SGA for a continuous period of that he was unable to perform SGA for a continuous period of 12 months. Now, the basis for the ALJ's conclusion, Mr. Hildebrand is contending, is that the ALJ has impermissibly become doctor in this case. He does, the emphasis that we are asking this court to focus upon is the predictive nature, the fact that McDonald itself uses the word prediction. It's a prediction. Well, who is able to make a prediction whether an impairment is going to last for a continuous period of 12 months? Whether it does or not is not the question. Is that the prediction can only be made by a doctor. Now, Mr. Hildebrand has satisfied his burden of proof by presenting evidence. The agency itself accumulated additional evidence. There's no question that it did, and there's no question that it could not have. Very simply, the ALJ could have picked up the telephone or could have written a letter to the treating doctor and said, on 10/28/94, what would be your assessment of this case? That was not done. The government argues over and over again that the medical evidence shows that Mr. Hildebrand was progressing and he was doing very nicely, and the doctors were saying, great, wonderful, we'll take you out of a cath and put you into a knee immobilizer and so forth and so on.
But how much money did he earn during that period of time that he was employed?
That is a question that I'm really unable to answer. I know the record contains some very puzzling...
Didn't he earn over $500 during that period of time?
Your Honor, I'm personally unable to say so. I'm a referral attorney. I have never met Mr. Hildebrand or even conversed with him. I think that the evidence that he earned more than the SGA level was addressed. The evidence was addressed by the vocational expert who was present at the hearing and who doubted the accuracy of the evidence, because it showed in certain cases that he was earning like the same amount, $300, $300, $300, I forget the interval of time that was involved.
Didn't he earn $774 in July 1995?
I really couldn't answer that without going back into the record. I don't know whether he did or not. All I could say is that at the time, I don't think $740 was the criterion. I think
isn't there a rebuttable presumption?
It's a rebuttable presumption.
If you're earning $500 or over?
Or more. It is a rebuttable presumption.
Of substantial gainful employment.
That is correct. You can be earning more and not really be doing substantial gainful activity. It could come from such things as vacation pay from last year, or it could come from pension or something of that nature.
Although they're referenced to various numbers, there's nothing in the record to indicate he earned less than $500 for substantial gainful employment.
Well, that is correct. I don't think there's any evidence, to be honest, one way or the other.
We hope you are.
Excuse me?
We hope you are.
I'm not sure what this white light means. Is that?
That means you're going into your rebuttal time from here on.
2 minutes.
Oh, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, counsel.
May it please the court. I'm Mark Mates, appearing on behalf of the commissioner. The agency would contend that, in fact, the decision was supported by substantial evidence. The ALJ here found, consistent with McDonald, that at no time during the relevant period was there any reasonable expectation that this individual would be unable to engage in substantial gainful activity for a continuous period of 12 months from the onset date. Under McDonald, this court stated that a person must be prepared to show that at the time she returned to work and thereafter, her disability was still expected to last at least 12 continuous months from the alleged onset date, otherwise she will not receive benefits. On the basis of the evidence for the ALJ reasonably evaluated whether there was any reasonable expectation that Mr. Hildebrand would be unable to engage in substantial gainful activity for a period of 6 months. The evidence following his accident did demonstrate gradual improvement, and in fact, his treating orthopedic surgeon, Dr. O'Connor, in May of 95, endorsed his return to work and allowed that he could engage in work activities that involved no lifting more than 10 pounds or no working on other than flat surfaces. Mr. Hildebrand returned to his regular work activity, and he argues that that return to work was inappropriately considered. In fact, the ALJ looked at the evidence with regard to his medical treatment, primarily to assess whether there was any expectation of disability. His treating medical sources did not indicate that there was any indication that he would be disabled, and consistently did observe positive improvements and allowed his return to work. As of September of 95, His findings, in fact, were quite consistent with those in March of 96, when Mr. Hildebrand concedes he was unquestionably able to engage in substantial gainful activity. And at that time, he had excellent range of motion in his knee. Furthermore, while there had been some suggestion in his brief that his valgus deformity, which is an angulation of the knee, was of concern, while Dr. O'Connor had allowed him at that time or suggested that he consider surgery, Mr. Hildebrand declined because he was quite satisfied with his condition at that point. The ALJ did look at the work activity, which would be wholly reasonable on this record. The claimant did demonstrate an ability to return to work, and he proffered evidence with regard to his earnings, which did raise a presumption of SGA, which he did not rebut. Furthermore, Mr. Hildebrand himself testified that his responsibilities continued to be the same at transcript 212, before and after his return to work. And his counsel before the ALJ in January of 99 explicitly conceded to the ALJ that Mr. Hildebrand engaged in substantial gainful activity beginning in July of 95, which would be somewhat at odds with his current position that it was not perhaps substantial gainful activity. And that's that transcript 198.
What about his earnings? You heard counsel's argument there that, you know, there was some question with respect to his earnings. What's your position on that, as to whether you earn more than $500?
Well, as the ALJ received the evidence of earnings by way of Mr. Hildebrand. And so in this instance, he was relying on evidence submitted by the person who was, in fact, seeking benefits. And Mr. Hildebrand himself testified that he really could not dispute that earnings information. So
that he received how much money?
Pardon me?
That he received how much money?
That he received the money, which was reflected in the payments at 175.
How much is it? That's what we're asking.
It appears to have been in excess of $500 per month.
And let me ask you this in terms of, and I meant to ask opposing counsel this, in terms of the trial work period, under the regs, is that supposed to begin before a claimant files an application for benefits?
It specifically is supposed to begin once they become entitled. I don't think that McDonald dealt with the whole issue of when we're looking at a retrospective period of an individual seeking disability. And so the McDonald construct was that we look at beyond the initial 5 month period, does the individual have any expectation of that he would be unable to engage in SGA? Under McDonald, if he has that reasonable expectation, satisfies the 5 month period, he would be disabled, and then he would be subject to the protection of a trial work period. So it would be following that disability entitlement that he would be entitled to a trial work period. And in this instance, the ALJ did thoroughly consider the concerns that were reflected in the McDonald case and did acknowledge that after, you know, the initial 5 month period, there was no reasonable expectation that this claimant would be unable to engage in SGA for a 12-month period. He noted the progression in terms of his medical condition, the endorsement of the physician that he could return to work, and then he also considered that, yes, in fact, this individual did return to work. There was no evidence that he was unable to perform that work to the satisfaction of his employer. The earnings information suggested that he was performing that work at an SGA level. So given all of those concerns, substantial evidence in fact supported the conclusion that this individual did not in fact satisfy the duration concerns of the Act in order to reach entitlement.
When did the trial work period begin with in relation to the application for benefits?
It would have been prior to the application. I think the application was...
Does the reg say to this effect the trial work period cannot begin before the month in which you file your application for benefits? That's 404-1592.
I'm sorry, I'm not finding the particular section.
404-1592E.
Yeah, I don't have that in front of me, but I'm not.
Do you have it on your side there?
Well, no.
You have it there?
No, I don't.
Okay. If that's correct, that a trial work period cannot begin before the month in which you file your application for benefits, how does that affect the case?
Well, that would, in a sense, take care of his access to any kind of trial work period. He wouldn't have access to it.
That would be dispositive of this case.
Yeah. So given these facts, the agency would contend that, in fact, substantial evidence supports the commissioner's determination.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Do you have anything else you wish to add?
Thank you. I believe that the trial work period, the entitlement to a trial work period, commences in the month in which you're entitled to disability insurance benefits. The Fourth Circuit, in the case of Walton, I believe, has indicated that an adjudication of whether or not you're entitled to those benefits is not required, but that's a different matter. I do want to point out...
So let me just make sure you're clear on that. So you're saying that the trial work period can begin before someone files the application for benefits, and the operative time is when you would be eligible or when you would qualify? Can you just go over that one more time?
Well, my understanding, Your Honor, is that the trial work period, according to the regulations, commences in the month in which the claimant is entitled to disability insurance benefits. And once that has been established, then the trial work period, the work that you're doing during the trial work period, is not considered in determining whether or not you're long-term claim for disability is valid or not. In other words, they don't use the fact that you go back to work to try to determine whether you can work or not. They don't use it against you. But in this case, they do, because they say he isn't entitled to them. So therefore, he's not entitled to trial work period.
Well, it isn't because he went back to work and he continued working all the way through?
Well, The point of it is that that's turning the cart upon its head.
Well, I mean, obviously he was able to work.
Correct.
And then he was not disabled. He was able to work for 5 or 6 months.
But that's not the issue raised by McDonald. The McDonald issue is it's prediction on the one hand, and if at the outset. See, they're talking about Dr. O'Connor makes determinations about his condition after the fact. Dr. O'Connor's never asked what happens as a prediction. Dr. O'Connor's, the McDonald is a prediction, it's forward-looking. And the ALJ is incompetent to make any determination. He can't say it's within a reasonable degree of medical certainty. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your
Thank you for your help.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will proceed to case.